This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, the U.S. strikes a nuclear bargain with Iran, and conservatives are furious. Also, Hobby Lobby, funny name, serious lawsuit, the latest legal challenge to Obamacare. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, can new online services like the crowdsourced shopping site The Prowl make holiday gift buying a little less horrible? And then our favorite offbeat kitchen maven Dan Pashman returns with his review of Thanksgiving highs and lows. And then director Alexander Payne's powerful new family drama, Nebraska.
Everybody's saying how Woody Grant's a millionaire. Well, that's the most exciting news around here for ages.
That's no big deal.
No big deal? Jeez!
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. After months of secret negotiations, Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama announced a six-month agreement with Iran to slow its nuclear program. Democrats are hailing it. Conservatives and Israel are apoplectic. Who's right? Then the Supreme Court will hear a bizarre new challenge to part of Obamacare. Should corporations owned by religious individuals be able to exempt themselves from parts of Obamacare on religious grounds? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
A group of world powers led by the United States struck a nuclear deal with Iran last week. The deal, which follows on secret talks between the U.S. and Iran in Oman, set out a six-month interim agreement that would step up inspection of nuclear sites, undo the higher-level enrichment that Iran has done with its nuclear material, and disable some of Iran's centrifuges. In exchange, Iran will retain a right to enrich uranium at a low level and will have sanctions on it slightly eased, and this will also presumably pave the way for a more permanent negotiation. The next stop, a full deal that would return Iran to the community of nations, ease its sanctions or get rid of its sanctions, and permanently, or at least apparently permanently, end its nuclear program. So, Emily, Israel...
Uh-oh.
What was the uh-oh?
You're
starting with you?
With me. That seems like uh-oh. Okay,
John,
go ahead.
Israel and the neocons are incensed about this. John Bolton, the former UN ambassador, wrote a piece in the Weekly Standard calling it abject surrender. It sets the precedent that Iran is allowed to enrich nuclear material. They say it undermines Israel. They say we should keep the sanctions in place and, if anything, make it harder for Iran to do anything. Why are they so upset, and is their fear justifiable?
When Hezbollah says this is a great agreement, bad for Israel, right? I mean, when the group that is arranges itself for the destruction of Israel heralds something, that is automatically bad for Israel. I think
that
also—
That is not true. You think that's true?
Yeah.
I don't think that's true.
When it comes to the topic of nuclear weapons for Iran, which has at one period or another its leader has talked about the extermination of Israel, I think that's bad for Israel. I think also the worry is that this represents a kind of weakening of U.S. ties with Israel, that we're not paying enough attention to Israel, that we're not listening to Israel, that the president is more anxious to get a deal with the Iranians. Also, I think neoconservatives are worried because they think that the Syrian kind of confusion in the president's policy, both his very slow response to the atrocities by the Syrian regime and then his kind of crazy gambit at the end, all seems perhaps a result of the fact that he didn't want to do anything in Syria, which is a client state of Iran in a way, do anything in Syria that would scuttle these talks, which have been going on for months. I think also the right to enrich, which is kind of a funny thing because the reason they think it's a surrender is it used to be the administration's position that Iran had to stop enriching everything altogether. Now they're allowed to enrich at a very low level, which isn't anywhere close to what they'll need to have actual material that could make a bomb. But the neocons worry that if you validate at all their right to enrich, you validate this notion that Iran was actually doing this just for energy purposes when that's not true. It's a total lie. They're trying to build a weapon. And so don't buy into their little fake that this is for energy purposes. And in 6 months, everybody will have kind of gotten more relaxed about what the true Iranian goal here is, which is to create an Islamic bomb. So those are some of the reasons that neocons are unhappy. So, do they have a right to be? you know, it looks like the deal, the way it's designed, is basically it's a 6-month trial period. A small amount of frozen assets are given to the Iranians. There's still an economic incentive for them to deal because lots of other parts of their economy are still crippled by sanctions. And if it doesn't go right, the sanctions can come back. And they've at least been slowed from what was a quickening pace towards getting a bomb.
So, Emily, now that John has given you the briefing and you're probably ready
Thank
to
you,
talk
John.
Here, is it the case that we have now reoriented ourselves in the Middle East, that it used to be we were a firm, it was just all about Israel, and then sort of secondarily we were aligned with Saudi Arabia because it's a large economic partner of ours and it was a forced counterweight to Iran and Syria. Have we now realigned so that really it's multipolar and we equally are happy with Iran, Saudi Arabia, Israel, they're all the same to us?
What? No, that's
okay. He's trying to
I'm trying to get you to like maybe say a sentence. That's all. Just anything.
I did.
He's making it easy for you. He's got a straw man. He set it all up nicely.
That's true. That was so nice of you, David. No, I don't think that we are imagining embracing Iran the way we have Israel or anything close to Saudi Arabia even. I think we are just talking to them directly for the first time since 1979. And I see this 6-month deal as a trial balloon to see if there's any way to build trust to any more lasting agreement. I always get confused, too, about the fundamental hypocrisy of these arrangements. I know that it would be bad for Iran to have a nuclear bomb. I'm not suggesting I think that's a good idea. But it's so weird to me that countries that possess these weapons then get to tell other countries that they can't even enrich uranium, which is what you also have to do to make peaceful nuclear energy, when it's something we do all the time. I have trouble getting over that logical hump. I'm not saying that I, you know, am out there cheering and I think we should go any further than we have to make it easier for them. And I also think, sure, probably the real reason they're enriching the uranium is weapons making. But I just always get confounded by that essential difference in the way we treat different countries.
I know I have a position on this which is radically out of line with everybody, but I really, really think that Iran is basically our natural ally in this region. Iranians they're like Texans. They are materialistic. They have big hair. They like oil. They're sort of religious fundamentalists, but also sort of like free-spirited. And, you know, they have a big middle class. Historically, it's a very well-educated population. It's true that they have zealot weasel mullahs who run the place. But that fundamentally—
And have for a long time.
Well, for a generation. But if you compare it to a country like Saudi Arabia, which is genuinely weird at a profound level, you know, has this whole way, treats women. It has basically a slave population of imported labor. I mean, that's a crazy country. The idea that that is our dear friend in the region and Iran is our mortal enemy is so bizarre to me. Iran is much closer to being a kind of country that we want in that region than any other country is.
Well, except that all that pluralism and that you were just imagining, I'm going to give the word pluralism for big hair and like to spend money, has not actually translated into a government that behaves reasonably.
Not yet, although we have, you know, there's a person who's the newly elected president who is in no sense, you know, a Democrat. He's in no sense like Joe Biden. He's a guy who's slightly to the center of where the crazy right wingers who rule the country is. But he's a step in that direction. And the country wants to move in that direction. And we need to foster it. And instead of treating this country as this implacable enemy that's bent on only one thing, which is the destruction of Israel and concomitantly the destruction of the United States, we should treat it like it's a regular country where we want to nurture it. And part of that is giving some legitimacy, giving some cover to the duly elected government and to treat it as a part of the community of nations. And I think that Israel and the neocons refuse to allow that shift in worldview. Because, you know, obviously, there are people within Iran who do want to destroy Israel.
I think what you're saying is you're saying the people of Iran, despite their leaders, are more in sync with us. But then when you are talking about Saudi Arabia, you're talking about the way the leaders of Saudi Arabia have set the system up in terms of the prohibition against women driving is not something that all women there are in favor of.
It's also a totalitarian monarchy.
Right. No, I know. But you know, I mean, it's
the leaders are
but
are
a theocracy.
In one sense.
A theocracy is no better than a totalitarian monarchy.
Oh, it's also theocratic totalitarian
right,
monarchy.
OK, fine. But I mean, the distinction you're making. So then a theocratic monarchy isn't that much different than just a theocracy. I mean, you're slicing the bologna pretty thin. I think if you're our basically foreign policy is based on interests.
They don't allow baloney in Saudi Arabia. You didn't know that.
It's based on our interests. And, you know, we are on the opposite side of Iran when it comes to Syria. We're on the opposite side of Iran when it comes to Hezbollah and funding terrorism. We're on the opposite side of Iran when it comes to the Palestinian question. Those are three, at least four, depending on how you count, huge differences we have with the state of Iran, separate and apart from this question of nuclear weapons. So in other words, it's not just the nuclear thing that's getting in the way of our
the state of Iran, its political views and its geopolitical interests are opposed to the U.S. in a number of places.
Oh, and Iraq, too. They don't like Iraq either.
No, they have a complicated relationship. It's like a neighbor. Look, they have Iraq has a majority Shiite population, just like Iran does, and there's a lot of ebb and flow and religious connection there. And
another way in which they're countered.
Iraq had a terrible war with Iran, and they want to be careful about it, but they're not. They want to make sure the United States is not on their border with 100,000 troops set to invade them out of Iraq or out of Afghanistan. That's true. All right, last question on this because I filibustered here. First, you, Emily, on this. Is there any chance, like let's say Iran is compliant over the next 6 months, they do what the terms of the deal are. Is there any chance a full settlement, a full agreement can get past a U.S. Congress?
I think no, unfortunately. And this is where the implacable opposition of Netanyahu in Israel and the Saudis is important, because a lot of congressional representatives will feel like that is a more important interest than supporting what could only be, you know, a set of unknowns. It will be taking a risk to reach a deal like that, even if things line up more in the way you say they should, David, than most Americans probably are used to thinking about. It still would be a big leap into the unknown, and I'm not sure that Congress would take that.
What do you think, John?
I think Congress has to play the bad cop throughout the next 6 months, because U.S. negotiators want to always be able to say, look, you know, we'd like to, you know, let you enrich to 3.5% or 5%, but we're never going to get anything through these crazies in Congress who are, you know, screaming and going nuts. So for the purposes of negotiating, there's no reason for Congress to let up on this at all. So
I guess I mean after that. That's a very good point about their strategic interest in the short term.
So it's a good question. So 6 months will be, you know, in the thick of a political year, and that'll be really hard.
Yeah. I guess what would they have to pass? They'd have to ease sanctions, right? They'd have to pass a law easing sanctions.
I guess that's right. And then you'd have to unwind the UN sanctions too, right? So we have sanctions and the United Nations has sanctions. So would they have to – I guess they would
– it would have to be legislation to get rid of our sanctions.
Yeah.
The UN stuff could probably go through. We would have the right to veto. And then there'd be a question of are we going to make a treaty?
Right.
Which would then require Senate ratification, which would, again, all seems pretty implausible. Coming up, can private corporations use their religious beliefs to duck out of Obamacare? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. The Supreme Court announced Tuesday that it would take a pair of new challenges to Obamacare, in particular to the contraceptive mandate in Obamacare. The most colorful lawsuit is one brought by Hobby Lobby, a huge, privately held craft behemoth based in Oklahoma.
Emporium.
It wants to be exempt from some of the contraceptive requirement of the Affordable Care Act on the grounds that that requirement violates its religious beliefs as a corporation when it provides the abortifacient kinds of contraception.
We need to asterisk that, because that is not clear that they in fact cause abortion, these
yes,
forms
they
of
claim, their claim is that these are
they
abortifacients.
Claim, and so it is like scientifically
the,
extremely...
The morning after pill and the pill, right?
The IUD.
Oh, and the IUD. Oh, the IUD.
Yes.
So Hobby Lobby won at the appeals court level. There are similar cases that have been making their way through other appeals courts, so they won at the Tenth Circuit. Other litigants have lost. There's a split in the circuits. The Supreme Court is taking it, will resolve it. It sets up a fascinating battle in the Roberts Supreme Court. So, Emily, just start talking, and we're going to sit back and listen and enjoy, and then have a great discussion about
uh-oh.
This.
Uh-oh. Another uh-oh moment. Yeah, these are really, really interesting cases. I mean, immediately at issue is the contraception mandate in Obamacare, and this question of whether corporations can argue that they are persons for the purpose of exercising religious freedom. So this is very, very much should make us remember Citizens United. So in Citizens United, the Supreme Court said corporations have personhood for purposes of being able to give unlimited donations to independent, in quotes, groups that are spending on elections. And that basically, in the context of free speech, that the companies counted in the same way that we would think of individuals counting. So companies like Hobby Lobby have seized on that logic and said, okay, so corporations should also be counted as persons under a federal law passed in 1993 called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that uses the word persons. And I think one of the things I keep noticing in the writing about these cases is that it's hard when you say their religious rights, once you start using that pronoun, not to be thinking straight to the owners. And when you think of the owners of Hobby Lobby and how their Christian beliefs don't support these kinds of birth controls, you think, okay, well, yeah, I can see how that could infringe on their religious rights. But we've always had the idea that a corporation is a separate legal entity, that it doesn't reflect the views of its owners directly, and that it's subject to different laws and doesn't have all the same rights as individual people do. So that's like the one of the big things at stake here. And, you know, the last thing I'll say before I stop talking is that, I mean, the implications of this, the slippery slope implications are pretty plausible. So once you could imagine a world in which a corporation can directly express its religious beliefs, what if, you know, you have an anti-discrimination law in a state that prevents discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and a gay couple wants to be photographed for their wedding, and the photographer refuses to take the picture because they're gay, the couple is gay, and the photography company owners think that, you know, gay marriage is a sin. This is a real case going on in New Mexico right now. Do we want companies to be able to get around laws in the way that this would open up? What if you're a Jehovah's Witness and you own a company and you don't believe in traditional health care at all? So then could you just not provide any health care coverage? Like, where's the end point here?
So as I understand it, your argument is the slippery slope argument is once you start calling corporations people, you just open up a whole range of possibilities. But in this case, can't you make it more narrow by saying that the test of the 93 Act, which amusingly was passed by Democrats in response to
a Scalia opinion.
A Scalia opinion, right, about Native Americans using
peyote.
Right. Anyway, so it's just interesting because when you think about something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you assume maybe that it was passed by Republicans. But anyway, isn't it that basically the state has to show a compelling reason for these corporations to provide this contraceptive coverage and that that limits?
Yeah.
Then that gets you to your question you raised at the first, which is, if Hobby Lobby allows the pill and a diaphragm but doesn't want these, what they think are abortifacients, what's the compelling health reason for those kinds of things that Hobby Lobby doesn't want to allow their employees to have?
They're safer for some women, or they're necessary for someone. A morning after pill is essential.
But I think, John, you have to think a little bit beyond Hobby Lobby. I mean, the next case would be an employer that doesn't want to cover birth control at all. That's like right there around the corner. The Supreme Court just happened to stick to two companies that were only objecting to particular forms of birth control. But do we really want the Supreme Court, you know, deciding which forms of birth control the health insurance should cover, as opposed to Congress and the president, the Congress having passed the Affordable Care Act with the requirements that it has?
Isn't it in the court's interest to judge this narrowly?
But they can't just issue a ruling that applies to Hobby Lobby and the particular facts here. I mean, I guess they essentially could. They could say, well, okay, corporations are persons for purposes of this federal religious freedom law. In this particular instance, this company just wants to ban a few forms of birth control. We don't think women really, really need those forms of birth control. So Hobby Lobby wins, but we're not saying anything about other kinds of healthcare provision. That would be pretty strange for them to go that narrow. And I just saying it the way I did makes it seem really unconvincing to me.
But my point is that couldn't they just stick to the compelling reason part?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're definitely right that the statute says that the government has to show a compelling reason for in some way burdening the religious rights of persons. So if companies are persons for this law, then you could say, okay, well, let's look only at whether the government has compelling reasons for this particular requirement in the contraception mandate. But it just immediately raises all these broader questions.
I don't see how you get to this idea that a corporation could be a person for religious purposes. I mean, I kind of get to where you get that for speech, that corporations actually, as corporations, have political interests that they want to advance as a corporation. But a corporation can't have a religious belief. A religious belief is inherently a personal, individual belief based on personal activity. So a corporation can't. I mean, I can see how a church...
But a corporation is a collection of people. And so if people get together and decide to form their corporation based on their religious views, then you have humans at the heart of it. But Emily,
I don't think that's insofar as you then seek safe harbor under the shelter of, you know, limited personal liability.
Right.
I think once you sort of seek a corporation and seek the protections of it and seek all the benefits of it, it seems to me you've lost any claim that you are a person for the purposes of religion.
So the judges that have found for companies like Hobby Lobby in these cases have made two counterarguments. One is that the Supreme Court, without a whole lot of discussion, has several times said that if you're a church or an incorporated nonprofit with a clearly religious purpose, that you have rights as if you were a person in other contexts. They have treated churches and associations as having free exercise rights under the First Amendment religion clauses. So that's point A. Point B is that if you look at Citizens United, the court said, okay, well, it's true that there is a possible problem with corruption if we let corporations give unlimited donations to independent political groups, but we're not worried enough about that to stop them. And so some of the judges have said, hey, in the context of religious freedom, there is no countervailing interest. We don't have to worry about something like corruption. And so if the Supreme Court was willing to treat corporations as persons for that purpose, then sure, we should treat
them
as persons.
What about the excellent Slate piece we had this week, which says actually there's a much more compelling constitutional interest, which is an Establishment Clause interest, which is that you're shoving—
I thought that was a great argument.
The religious practices of this, the owners of this corporation, down the throats of all the people who happen to work there. And you're depriving them of the kind of health benefits and their compelling interests in their own gynecological and you know.
Well, that gets you back to whether this is a compelling health need. And I don't know what the science of that is. I don't know how much more beneficial on the healthcare front those kinds of.
Well, Congress has said it's really beneficial and that they've passed a national law which mandates this for essentially every organization that provides health insurance.
But Congress has said supply contraception, but they're not making a determination on what kinds of contraception are.
No, they did.
Better.
Right?
Well,
they said it has to be comprehensive and it includes the morning after pill and the IUD. Of course you would include those two forms.
Right. So, but my question is, if the health is the question, are there all kinds of wonderful benefits? And I think the answer is yes, but to the IUD that you would be depriving people of if you took that off of the healthcare list?
Yes, to look at the science first, briefly, you know, the IUD is, I think, the most effective form of long-term contraception. It's incredibly convenient. You know, there is some debate about whether it prevents implantation of a fertilized zygote, but it's not clear that it does. And so this whole idea that it itself is an abortifacient is very contested. The morning after pill is the thing you take if you have unprotected sex and you right away realize it and you want to not get pregnant. There isn't a substitute for it.
No, I know, but you can't argue that. My point is, leaving aside the abortion question, are there health benefits that somebody who is on the other side of Hobby Lobby could say, you are depriving your employees of these health benefits, not you're depriving them of the ability to end pregnancies they don't want.
But then ending a pregnancy you don't want is a health benefit, right?
Okay.
Because if you find out that you're pregnant and you stop it right away, then you're not going through the experience of several weeks of pregnancy, which has some risk and certainly is psychologically an issue.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Nebraska, it's the new movie from director Alexander Payne. And then we talk about social media shopping and the website The Prowl with our own Dana Stevens. And finally, Dan Pashman of The Sporkful and our own erstwhile producer joins us to talk about the Thanksgiving meal. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Dana, do I always say your name in this kind of extra perky way? What's it about? Like, I'm no more or less glad to see you than Julia.
You think you've been saying Dana's name with extra perk all these years?
Yeah, it's like,
it's like a slight I haven't even noticed.
Yeah, hey, Dana.
You know what I haven't heard in a while is Dana.
That, and we'll throw in a few of those. And, you know, the good excuse to do it is our first topic is, of course, a movie film by the director Alexander Payne. And I have a little intro for people who haven't seen it. So it's the new movie from Alexander Payne. It's called Nebraska. Payne is the director best known for Election, Sideways, The Descendants. Am I leaving anything out? Bout Schmidt.
Citizen Ruth, Election.
Citizen Ruth, yeah. Great director, really interesting director. The movie, this one stars Bruce Dern as an elderly and possibly senile man who believes, thanks to a direct mail marketing pitch, that he has won $1 million. And we follow Dern's character on the road trip he takes with his adult son named David, played by Will Forte, to Lincoln, Nebraska to claim these phantom winnings. The film is a study in controlled absences, implied pasts, austere landscapes. It's in black and white. There is the weight of incentives through it. And like all of Payne's other movies, it is takes place in that sort of uncertain border zone between funny ha-ha and dark melancholy. Would you agree with all that?
I would, indeed. Okay. I like that bit about absences. I don't know what that was, but it sounded very writerly.
Yeah, I have no idea what it means either. But anyway, for those of you who don't know what a controlled absence is or haven't seen the movie, why don't we listen to a clip from Alexander Payne's new movie, Nebraska.
Come on. Let me take you home.
I'm going to Lincoln. It's the last thing I do. I don't care what you people think.
Listen to me. You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam. So you got to stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
You didn't even have a suitcase.
I'm not staying there.
Dad, I can't let you go.
It's none of your business.
Yes, it is. I'm your son.
Well, then why don't you take me?
I can't just drop everything and drive to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, what else you got going on?
All right, well, Dana, I will start with you. What did you think of this movie? First of all, do you like Payne's movies by and large?
Love. Yeah. He's one of my favorite American living directors,
and
I think.
And say what? I'm curious. I mean, I think he is one of mine, too. I know I will see a movie if he has made it, but why?
I guess because he aims for a tone that no other director is really trying for right now. As you say, I mean, he's sort of in between satire and drama, right? I mean, he pokes fun at his characters, but in kind of an affectionate way. There's social satire, but they're also really sort of about human dramas. I don't know. He occupies a space that no one else quite does. He's very funny and clever and writerly, and yet his movies are very sort of visually beautiful, too. I mean, it's not that I love every one of his movies. Actually, his last one, The Descendants, was probably my least favorite that he's done. And so I really felt like he was back in the saddle with Nebraska. And I love Nebraska. It's one of my favorite movies.
Okay, well, tell me what you love. Because I'm not sure whether I loved it. I'm kind of inclined to think I didn't love it, but I could be persuaded. So tell me what you loved about it.
Let's see. Well, just free associating, the music is really great. It has a fantastic score by Mark Orton. It has a kind of, it's black and white cinematography, as you mentioned, right? So it's got a very, very austere kind of palette. It takes place in a part of America that we never see in the movies, except Alexander Payne movies, which is Nebraska. And even Alexander Payne, he's made films in Omaha before, set in Omaha. I think he has 4 movies set there. But not in rural Nebraska, which is not where he grew up. It is sort of an exotic landscape even for him. Mm. So it has that kind of travelogue element that's great. And Bruce Dern is just magisterial. I think he won Best Actor at Cannes for this performance, and it really sort of feels to me like, you know, at 77 or however old he is, he's kind of reinventing himself as an actor, right? Mm-hmm. Because we always see Bruce Dern playing the crazy guy, the weird guy, you know, the Vietnam vet and coming home, like the slightly off-balance person, Tom in The Great Gatsby. And to see him playing someone like this who's so inward, and his character is an alcoholic and sort of a permanently depressed man who doesn't seem able to reach out to anyone, who's completely indifferent to his son, who's, you know, doing him this kind of bizarre favor of driving him across 3 states to go collect a non-existent prize. And I don't know, there's just something, I said in my review of the movie that there's something almost Lear-like about the mm-hmm. character, about the character of Woody that he plays in this movie, someone who's kind of surveying the ruin of his life, you know, from almost the end of it.
That's remarkable. I hadn't thought of it as a retelling of Lear, but they are almost like Lear and, who is he with? He's not with Gloucester. Who is he with on the heath?
Kent? The Fool?
It's the Here and the Fool on the heath, exactly. Julia, here's what I meant by controlled absences, because I know you care. This man, the Bruce Dern at the heart of this movie, is a massively withdrawn human being, right? And the number of lines that Bruce Dern speaks in the movie could be fit on a single page, probably, and yet it is a gigantic performance, right? So whatever absences we're feeling in terms of amount of dialogue or emotional revelation are very controlled, which is why it's a great performance. What did you think of his performance? What did you think of the movie? Did you like it as much as Dana?
I think I might be in your boat, Steve, of not quite knowing what I made of it. But I think I liked it. I,
think I liked it a lot, actually. And I think that part of it is loving Alexander Payne's vision of the world, which at once seems very mannered and particular, and the black and white cinematography sort of distances us from normal human experience. On the other hand, his characters just feel so motivated by all the things that actually motivate us in the real world, and their reactions to things seem both incredibly complex and low-key in the manner of how people respond to things in the real world. Like, there's one character in the movie who's a previous girlfriend of the Woody character that Will Forte's character runs into, and he's sort of enchanted by the woman, who seems very sweet and charming and literate and maybe possibly more delightful than his own mom, than he currently finds his own mom, who's a bit of a hectoring, blunt, and not particularly gentle or tender woman. And you see him imagining this alternate life for his dad that his dad might have had if he'd ended up with this other woman. But his response to this encounter is very subdued. He sort of meets her. You can kind of see him wondering about these alternate possibilities. At one point, he asks his dad about this woman, and his dad is sort of like, "Eh, it doesn't matter. I don't remember." And you can see how all of the different ways that one might build a life and the possibilities of how it might unfold are both hugely important, right, to every day of how you live, and also something you just kind of have to let go of and get on with.
Mm. I think that's very well said, Julia. And without spoiling anything, I think I can say that almost the last shot in the movie in which you see that woman's face and the faces of some other people that they've encountered on their journey really brings that theme home about how, you know, every life contains a million different unlived lives within it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. That was beautifully said. But the thing that maybe limited my response to the movie is we are left to guess what's going on internally with Will Forte as these revelations are paraded before him. And you could say that it's of a piece with this, you know, totally austere landscape. I mean, the movie's about an emotional landscape that completely mirrors the actual physical landscape, and is very much about the inability of that landscape to reproduce itself economically, right? The Great Plains were once at least somewhat economically thriving. They're now total wasteland. They're total gerontocracy. Everyone in the film, almost without exception, is either a complete left-behind dead-ender or incredibly old, right? And so you have, that's why Will Forte is also another center of the movie. It's like, well, what legacy is this guy living with? And that's what he's sort of trying to figure out, but he's drawn a little bit as a blank.
I guess I didn't find Will Forte's character to be a total blank. I mean, he was, to use Julia's perfect term, subdued, right? Everyone in this movie is very emotionally subdued. But there are moments, especially, and again, I can't give away the end, but, you know, some of the gestures that he makes toward his father at the end, I think that you do see some sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, but some sort of pilgrim's progress that he's completed throughout the movie. And I think Will Forte, who's known primarily as a Saturday Night Live comedian, is really, really great in this role and really nails it.
All right. Well, the movie is Nebraska. It's from the director Alexander Payne. It stars Bruce Dern in a remarkable performance, and Will Forte in some ways equally remarkable performance. Go check it out. Let us know what you think of it. Coming up, online shopping taps into the wisdom of crowds, but can the crowd really help me find the perfect turtleneck? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for some of the things that we talk about on the program, we collect them all at our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave us a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. For years now, I've been searching for the perfect turtleneck, the kind of wide-rib, medium-weight, funky-colored sweater that a guest on an early Sesame Street episode might wear. But this is not, I'm not speaking now in my, I mean, it is my own speaking voice, but it's the writing voice of Dana Stevens that I'm now quoting. In order to find that perfect turtleneck, she joined The Prowl, a social networking site founded last August by the creators of the parent networking sites Cafe Mom and its spinoffs, Mama Latinas and The Stir. Dana, The Prowl is basically it's a social network shopping site. It's a rival to Pinterest and various other things. Not one word from turtleneck on that I've just said means anything to me. They have no semantic weight or value in the brain of Stephen Metcalf. So this is a great opportunity for you to explain what the F WTF this piece is really about.
Okay, first of all, Steve, I want to call bullshit on that. You are like the biggest shopper of the three of us. You're always coming in here with some amazing object that you found or some like beautiful consumer experience.
Are you tripping?
So I don't want you to play like, oh, I've just got my nose in my Tolstoy over here while you ladies be shopping. I mean, that's crazy. Also, we've got to note, this is like the elevation of Dana's endorsement last week, because she endorsed The Prowl and it got elevated to a piece and then it got elevated to a segment.
It's a spinoff of that endorsement because Jessica Winter, an editor at Slate, asked me, do you want to turn your endorsement of The Prowl into a piece on The Prowl? I guess they were looking for kind of Christmas-related shopping pieces. And believe me, I am not the person to write the tech shopping piece, but that was kind of what made it fun. So exploring this website kind of made me realize, whether or not you love this particular website and its functionality, this is a thing that people need. We need an Instapaper for shopping, essentially, right? So you're surfing the web, you're finding articles you want to read, you don't have time to read them now, you save them to your Instapaper. We don't really have any such thing for commerce. And in fact, I used to use my Instapaper for that. So as I'm scrolling through, you know, reading something from the New York Review of Books, up pops Glitter Turban or some bullshit.
By the way, it's twinkling nicely now, Dana.
Now you know my eBay search history shame. No, but so this is essentially for me just sort of a place to save things that you are thinking about buying for yourself or somebody else in neat little categories that you can easily access from your desktop. And it's been fun exploring it for that reason. Have you guys tried it?
I have tried it, and I was kind of shocked. So yesterday I created an account and I set up two requests, one for a big shag rug so that when my twin sons start to toddle around as they're beginning to do and topple over, their heads won't get bonked too badly as they currently do on our thin, cruel, non-child-friendly rug that we have. And second, for a clutch with which to go to weddings and things like that. And I basically expected, because the site doesn't feel hugely populated, it doesn't totally feel like Pinterest, like it's
not humming like Pinterest yet, right? Because it has, I don't know the exact number, but thousands of users as opposed to millions of users.
Right. It doesn't totally feel like it's off the ground. So I kind of assumed that I would check in this morning and find, like, not that much. And sure enough, on the rug request, I had lots and lots of suggestions, I was startled to note, but they're all from the Prowl team. So clearly the folks who are running the site are sort of populating things and trying to make it a good experience for new users like me. On the other hand, my blingy bag request, there were 18 bags there of all sorts and stripes, including a cork glitter clutch that looked nice and one that had kind of sequin, orange daisy sequin arrangements. I mean, it was like some options. And it also created in me a sense of gratitude / obligation to the people who had proposed these glitter clutches. So I started looking up the profiles of the folks who'd basically done, you know, free shopping research for me. They'd been like my personal shoppers without compensation. And I was like, wow, I probably owe these ladies a solid. I better go see what their shopping questions are and whether I can solve any of their shopping problems. Someone else was looking for a good present for tweens. So I was like, oh, I better put the last thing I gave the tween girls in my life. I don't have time for any of this if it weren't preparation for this segment. I barely have time to shop anymore now that I have kids.
But this can save you time shopping.
I don't think it can.
Well, I think I picked out my daughter's Christmas present based on some recommendations that people sent me on the site. So now I don't have to spend that half an hour going to a million different websites looking for mushroom-themed toys.
All right. So this raises a couple questions, and pardon me if they've been answered implicitly or otherwise. But how did those people find you and your request?
So there's a feature on the site where everyone can just post questions. Help me find is like a category of question that you can post. I think you can also post obsessed with me about is a different stripe of question. Where you
and then
kind
style
of,
this. You can say like, here's my new shirt. Find me some pants to go with it.
Right. So, but help me find seems to be the most commonly used. So you can post help me finds and you can also review everybody else's help me finds. Mm-hmm. You can poke around and look for questions if you're like a benevolent shopping fairy who wants to help other people shop.
Isn't that where this system breaks down just a little bit? What kind of weird obsessive weirdo goes lurking around this site just trying to do people favors?
Nobody in the Steve Metcalf universe, that's who.
Not in the austere rural landscape where I'm from.
Well, here's the thing. Shopping with people is joyous. I mean, I'm someone who totally enjoys shopping with people. It's part of how I was raised. The Nebraska about my life might be called Frugal Fanny's, which is a great discount place on Route 1 in Massachusetts. And you could do the black and white shoot of my mom and sister and I going to hunt for coats after Thanksgiving, which we'll probably do again this weekend, and trying on discount coats by the rackful and assessing the fall of their lapels. I love shopping with my mom and sister. It's a great joy of my life. Doing that for strangers on the web, I felt like for this site to really work for me or be something I would want to be involved in, I would have to actually get to know, my friends would have to be on it.
Right. Well, that's why I wrote about it. I want all my friends to get on it. So it can become something where I see a sweater that's So Julia and I just send it to you quickly.
Right. I would have had more fun helping you find presents for your daughter than helping this random, I'm sure perfectly lovely, stranger find presents for a tween.
I mean, put it this way, social shopping online is less lonely than shopping online by yourself. You know, it's a lot less boring than just sitting there going through site after site after site thinking like, oh, that doesn't look right.
Yeah, it's true. Are you guys big online shoppers in general?
Well, OK, to the extent that I could ever freaking embody something called the man's perspective, here's the man's perspective on this conversation, which is like in one way, I'm utterly a stereotypical man, which I hate going shopping for clothes. I absolutely loathe it. It's just, to me, I just feel like this kind of spritzy sweat gathers on the bridge of my nose the instant I walk into a retail establishment and there are these fluorescent lights trained on me and I'm ungainly and disgusting looking and everything I touch makes me only more like Chris Farley. And I slink out of there having paid way too much money just for the privilege of getting out of there alive, right? I hate it. I hate it. And so for me, online shopping is quite liberating in a way. I love, like, go to Norse Project and get a down vest, click medium, give me another one. And and so I love online shopping. It's great. But I'd like it to stay completely emotionally withdrawn and lonely.
Let me point out that you can choose what to share on the site. It's not like Facebook, which is just basically up in your underwear drawer all day long.
The piece is by Dana Stevens. It's called The Platonic Turtleneck. It's about this social media shopping site called The Prowl, which she endorsed last week. Go check it out. All right. Well, we're joined for our last segment. We're joined by the wonderful Dan Pashman, who some people in our audience definitely know your name as our erstwhile producer, Dan, right? Many more, of course, know your name as the creator and host of the wonderful food podcast, The Sporkful. But I know you primarily as the man who grossly misjudged a granola tasting competition. But welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you. You're on
to talk about Thanksgiving food.
Yeah, I'm glad you're over that whole granola kerfuffle, Steve. That was only, 3 years ago?
Yeah, no, it's like there's Bush Gore. There's, give me another one. I don't know. You know, Watergate.
Right.
And then there's the granola competition. But I'm working through it. It's a process.
Great.
I think we all are as a nation.
Yeah, we're Kubler Rossing it, and we're somewhere in there. But anyway, so welcome to the show. We're going to talk about the Thanksgiving meal. And Dan, what it strikes me about the, and I should say before we dig in here that we recorded the segment before Thanksgiving, but of course it gives you plenty of lead time to prepare for your next Thanksgiving if anything we say influences you. And also Thanksgiving is all about the leftovers. So anyway, here we go. The defining thing about the Thanksgiving meal is it's about being comforted, not surprised, right? So it sort of unfolds ritualistically on a certain timetable. And if there was something new or different, it wouldn't matter what its intrinsic worth might be to your palate. It would meet with controversy around the table, right? So effectively, Thanksgiving is about a lack of creativity, but an abundance of comfort. Is this what's good about it or bad about Thanksgiving?
I think mostly that's what's good about it. I mean, I think that Thanksgiving is really, it's like cooking a turkey. Assuming that you're cooking a turkey takes a really long time. It's a momentous occasion. You don't just throw a turkey in the oven on Tuesday night while the kids are hungry for dinner, you know. And so that's a big deal. And many of the other dishes in Thanksgiving are a big deal. Like the fact that these are dishes that we don't eat all together very often, to me, makes it a good kind of comfort.
Right. Why do we take them? By the way, is there something about a turkey? Is it just the labor intensivity of it that we eat it only in, you know, pre-made boar's head deli slices? Or once a year in this gigantic ritual of cooking a giant bird.
Yeah, I mean, turkeys are really big, so it takes a long time to cook one of them. I mean, I do sometimes, I'll go to the farmer's market and just get like turkey thighs or a turkey breast. And that's the kind of thing you can throw in the oven and cook in 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to cook a whole turkey, you just need to know that you're devoting time to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I actually think Thanksgiving is one of the days of the year when I wouldn't mind being a vegetarian because the turkey to me seems completely ancillary to the pleasures of the meal. Like, I could give a darn about that turkey. I don't know why I suddenly got super shy. As you know, I'm a very demure speaker.
Well, you know WNYC bleeps the word darn.
I'm sure they do.
Unless you're talking about darning socks, yes. Then it can stay in.
But then it's on the fence, right?
Turkey to me is like the plinth upon which the bounty of the Thanksgiving meal rests. You don't really need to eat the plinth. All I care about is the sides, the veggies, and then I like the desserts. I would say in order of importance for me, it's the veggie bounty, then pumpkin pie, and then I like some turkey as like a base.
So you do eat some turkey?
Oh, of course. But
because you really want it or because you feel obligated?
No, it's delicious and it's there. But like if I had to kick various... Also, my family's bananas about size. I mean, we typically have like between 8 and 13 different vegetable options on the table. And so if I had to cut that down to a total of like 6 items on the table, I would pick 6 of the sides and just boot the turkey.
What are your priorities, Dana?
I don't know. I guess I would say that the dishes that it all comes down to on the savory side is mashed potatoes and gravy. You got to have mashed potatoes as a kind of absorbent, you know, sponge on the plate for all the other flavors. And stuffing also in the savory department. And then for dessert, of course, pie. You have to have pie.
Do you have a strategy for constructing the mashed potatoes on the plate so that they hold in the gravy and that they don't it doesn't corrupt other foods you might not want it to touch?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess you just make your basic moat in the middle, right?
A moat would be the liquid around. I think what you're talking
about is a lagoon.
It's like a tarn, I think, which is a tarn is a name for like a discrete mountaintop lake. I think that's what...
Can I just say I love Julia so much for having used the words plinth and tarn in this conversation?
It's a tarn. It's a tarn of gravy. It's not a moat.
But WNYC also bleeps tarn, so this segment's unusable. But since I have to, in past years, have had to compensate for the lack of meat, I'm basically a Close Encounters of the Third Kind mashed potato eater, right? Remember that scene? He just piles them higher and higher and higher. Because what I need is like something like the tryptophan... high or low or whatever. I need that comatose, overcarbed, you know, aftermath with which to fall asleep watching football, which to me is the essence of Thanksgiving. Like watching 2 to 3 football games of a total of about 12 hours of totally passive viewing with other completely silent, repressed wasp men in a half state of
half. It's kind
coma.
Of like Nebraska on the Upper East
it's
Side.
That is a very universal thing, yeah.
So what's this Porkful Thanksgiving? What are your innovations? Like, how are you...
How much time you got? I ordered turkey from local farm. I brine my turkey, although there was just a very interesting piece by Kenji Lopez-Alt. He does the Food Lab segment of Serious Eats arguing that maybe brining isn't quite all it's cracked up to be, but it's still very... I like brining. I just like the momentousness of it. Also, I just feel like the turkey should be as complicated... and involved as possible. Like, this is the day. So I'll brine the turkey, brine it upside down for partway, right side up for partway, although it's completely submerged at all times, about 24 hours. Then cook it for the first hour or two upside down so the juices flow down into the breast as opposed to away from the breast. Then flip it. It does mess up the skin on the top a little bit, but, you know, I only care about how it tastes, not so much how it looks.
Dan Pashman is the host and the creator of the Sporkful podcast. You can, of course, find it on iTunes and anywhere else that you get your podcasts. Dan, it was so awesome not only having you on this segment, which was a total delight, but as our producer for a number of years, it was just an absolute every day was joyous.
Well, really thanks, guys. It was joy for me as well. I really appreciate getting to work with all you guys, having been a fan before being a producer, and I love what you guys do, so I was psyched to be able to make my little contribution.
Excellent. Well, good luck, and from now on, you're dead to me for leaving the show. Get out of here.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our program where we endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you got?
Okay. Well, my daughter has this amazing teacher this year, two amazing teachers, actually, who bring a guitar to class or keep a guitar in the classroom and play great songs with the kids. And as a result, I'm always discovering these great songs that I didn't know. And the other day, she came home singing this beautiful little kind of folk ditty called Close Your Eyes and Listen. And so I started Googling it so I could learn the song to sing with her. And I discovered this singer-songwriter, Arthur Russell, who wrote the song, who I've never heard of before. Do you guys know Arthur Russell?
No.
So he's this guy who was active in the early 70s through 1992. He died of AIDS in 1992. He was a bisexual guy and a composer, cellist, just a really, really interesting musical figure who I'm now exploring and really, really loving. So he started off as a classical cellist and composer, and he studied with Ali Akbar Khan, who's the great kind of Indian music master. And then he got involved in like the art rock scene and made music with David Byrne and was involved with The Kitchen and was just sort of had his hand in all these different pies in like art rock in the early 70s. And so the album that I'm just starting to explore now is called Love is Overtaking Me. The first song on it is this beautiful song, Close Your Eyes and Listen, that maybe we can do as an outro. Yeah, he seems really fascinating, and I don't know why people don't talk about Arthur Russell more.
Mm, that's cool. Julia, what do you got?
I also have a song, so we can see which of us Sally likes better by which song
Clint
wins the
outro. Clint
B. Tarn. The outro competition. It's by a band I hadn't heard of called St. Lucia, which I learned about because another song of theirs was used in the trailer for Looking, which is the HBO show that my husband's been working on. But the song I fell in love with was one called Closer Than This, and it's just anthemic and poppy and joyous and lovey-dovey, and I've really been enjoying it. So it's St. Lucia, Closer Than This.
Yeah. All right. Well, mine literally is an endorsement of Bruce Springsteen, a live clip of him on YouTube doing the song This Hard Land to end his Wrecking Ball tour in Kilkenny, Ireland. It just brought back to me like the dialectic of Bruce Springsteen, which I can't escape from. There's like a Hegelian, you know, a prison that I'm trapped in with him, which is I can't figure out whether he is really this kind of distillate genius of the American spirit that he presents himself as in a weird way, or whether he's this kind of buffoon who in 50 years people will look back on and say, I cannot believe anyone listened to this music, right? It's this funny act or whatever. And what I like about that song is it seems to embody both Springsteens in a way, right? It's like, it's sort of about inflating Americana, you know, the idea of Americana in a romantic way, but it's sort of about like being sold that as a bill of goods. I think, I don't know, I can't quite decide. But I love that version of that song, so that's my endorsement. Dana Stevens, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Did I say Dana today?
You did now.
Okay. Julia, thanks. That was fun.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Sally Herships and Mike Buolo. Interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week. Down where the trees grow to